Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Professor Som Naidu in this episode. Som is the Pro Vice Chancellor of Flexible Learning and Director, Centre for Flexible Learning at the University of South Pacific, Fiji. He has a rich career history and some interesting perspectives on technology, education, and design. It's my pleasure to be talking with Professor Som Naidu. Som is the Pro Vice Chancellor of Flexible Learning and Director, Centre for Flexible Learning at the University of the South Pacific, following an incredible international career that has seen him editing one of the world's premier distance education journals and participating in multiple influential research projects, which we're about to learn more about. Som, it's great to be talking with you.
Thank you, Mark. That's very kind of you and very generous comments. Pleasure talking to you.
Great. Som, can we get away with a brief overview of your career and publications?
I started off my professional career as a teacher, as a high school teacher. And very quickly, within a year or so, I realized that this is really what I wanted to do. I just enjoyed being in a classroom. Of course, in those days, it was mostly in the classroom and in a high school setting in Fiji. This is where I was born. And so I taught high school for a couple of years, and I enjoyed the classroom experience. I just enjoyed being with young people and learning from them and trying to help them out. So it was a no-brainer kind of thing. And I thought, now this is where I want to be, and this is what I want to study. So at that early stage, when I was about early 20s, I wrote a letter in those days to University of Auckland in New Zealand, because, you know, from Fiji, you sort of look towards Australia and New Zealand in those days. So I wrote a letter to University of Auckland saying that, listen, I wanted to study for a bachelor's degree in education. And they said, oh, well, we don't do education here, but we do education at University of Waikato, which was really beginning in those days. So they accepted me for a degree program at University of Waikato. So I went there, I think late 70s, and did a Bachelor of Education degree. And for some odd reason, I came back to Fiji and then taught high school again. But very quickly, I realized that wasn't enough. And I got a job at the University of the South Pacific, which was, you know, 10 years or so into the making and establishment. And I got a job as a course developer, as an instructional designer. It was called course developer positions in the extension services in the Distance Education Center. And the University of the South Pacific, for those of your listeners, is a regional university that covers 12 countries in the Southwest Pacific region, and was set up by the governments of New Zealand, Australia, and the UK at that time. It's an organization for higher learning for all these small island states, which could not afford to have educational institutions of that kind. And invariably, people had to go to Australia and New Zealand. So USP was set up with a mandate to serve the region as a whole, although most of its resources were based in Fiji. So it was doing a lot of distance teaching, developing printed materials and shipping them out to very remote locations. Sometimes, you know, it would take weeks and months for course materials to reach, you know, islands out in the Pacific, such as Tokelau or Kiribati or Niue. But so it was very much a print-based operation, but also used a sort of old weather satellite that the Americans had no use of. So they gave it to USP to do some audio conferencing and basically, at that time, it was audio conferencing. So we were using audio conferencing largely for meetings of administrators and educators in the Pacific region, but also sometimes it was being used for tutorials. So I got a job as a course developer, helping academics develop courses for that kind of learning and teaching operation. And that was my sort of that introduced me to what was then called distance education, or correspondence education mostly, but in a decade or so, the concept of distance education became more common. I started studying for a master's in distance education, and one of my earliest encounters at that time was an Australian called Kevin Livingston. You know, he died not so long ago. But he was a very strong influence in my life at that moment. So he developed a program, academic program, with a very strong set of courses on distance education. One of the first, I mean, even Australia, I think, at that time did not have an academic program. Deakin University, I think, and University of South Australia were beginning to develop programs like that. So USP in those days actually had a master's program, and I was one of their first students. So I studied that master's program with Kevin Livingston as a sort of sole student for a little while. But I found an opportunity to go and spend a bit of time in Montreal at Concordia University. Now, that was my first big watershed moment. You might wonder how, you know, because in those days there was no email. How did I find out? And it's a very interesting story. I was getting more and more interested in educational technology because of what I just said. So I was looking for programs around the world which had some educational technology bias, and I came up with an old yearbook, educational technology yearbook, which had a little bit of a description of an EdTech program at Concordia University in Montreal. So I wrote a letter, and lo and behold, they wrote back, you know, and they invited me to come. And so I went in 1985, would you believe it? I went to Montreal in the thick of winter. In January 1985, I left Fiji to go to Montreal, you know. Yes. And I spent 6 months there, you know, working with people, and I was so fascinated by what these guys were doing. I said, all right, I'm going to come back to Fiji, finish my master's, and I'm coming back here to do my PhD. So I was very clear about that. So that was my big watershed moment in 1987. I started an educational technology program at Concordia University. And there were some people there, in the likes of Gordon Pask, you know, the British educator, psychologist, cybernetician, and Stafford Beer, who is also a very strong influence, and they were visiting professors in the educational technology program. So this was in the Faculty of Education, but very oddly, they had people in this program from learning sciences, from computer sciences, from engineering sciences, and they were looking at education from a variety of points of view, not just from a technology point of view, the hardware or the software point of view, very much from a cybernetician's point of view and a systems design point of view. Stafford Beer, for example, used his approach to operations research in designing, actually helping governments, you know, as you would find if you look him up. And of course, as you will know, having spent time in the UK, Gordon Pask's work was really the foundation of a lot of work that Diana Lawyer-Lodge eventually started doing in conversations theory. So it was a very exciting program, and I spent 4 years doing a PhD there, and then spent a year teaching in the same program, after which I moved to Australia. So I worked at the University of Southern Queensland, which is a very strong distance education program in those days. And I worked at the University of Southern Queensland with the likes of Jim Taylor and Vernon White, who were, you know, stalwarts of the distance education approach in Australia at that time, till 1997. This was another big watershed moment, that I was looking for a place to go for a sabbatical about 1997. And I found some very exciting work at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois, which is just out of Chicago. And there was this guy, Roger Schenck, you know, who was another huge influence on my thinking. And he was a professor of computer science and psychology at Yale University. And at that time, Anderson Consulting, which was a very big company at that time in the U.S., gave him, I think, $10 million or $30 million U.S. dollars to start up, develop, you know, educational software for their workers. So he took a whole bunch of people from Yale and came to Northwestern and set up what he called at that time the Institute of Learning Sciences. It's about that time the concept of learning science, which was drawing from cognitive science and computer science, the idea of learning science was just being born, and Roger Schenck had a large part to play in the development of learning science as a field of practice. He was instrumental in developing the Journal of Learning Sciences. So these were not about they were not about distance education per se. They were talking about learning, and they were talking about cognition. They were talking about technology, and that fascinated me because I thought that was really the heart of the matter, as opposed to the approach, which is what we call distance education. And there I encountered people like Alan Collins. Of course, Alan Collins is largely responsible for this whole idea of situated cognition. You know, the classic article that they wrote around 1989, Alan Collins and Dugui, I think, from Xerox PARC, they wrote this classic article on situated cognition and the culture of learning. Brown, Collins, and Dugui, that's right. And that was a huge influence. So these two things were a huge, major influences in my graduate education and early career. So I of course subsequently I spent time at Manchester Metropolitan University, where Fred Lockwood, our colleague, was there, and I spent time with him, and then University of London, and also at in Universitat Obert and Catalonia in Barcelona. Well, currently I'm at USP now. In a sense, you know, kind of went round the circle because I started here, and then went away for all around the world for 30 years, and actually I left Fiji in 1987, and came back to Fiji in 2017, exactly 30 years, and to take up a position as Pro Vice Chancellor for Flexible Learning and Director of the Center for Flexible Learning, which is where I am at the moment, you know, and most of my role here, as you would appreciate, is about leadership, strategic leadership in the area of learning and teaching, policy design and development, work around technology-enhanced learning, and the professional development of academics. The things like that I've been doing all along, you know, and throughout this career, you know, I have published heavily, as you noted, you know, and around 1997, about the time when I left USQ to go to University of Melbourne to take up an associate professorship there in educational multimedia and technology, I assumed the executive editor role of the Distance Education Journal, which is owned by the Open and Distance Learning Association of Australia, and I'm pleased to report that I've been editing that journal for 23 years, and I'm only the second editor. Because the first two editors were Ian Mitchell and Desmond Keegan, who are the gurus of distance education, and I'm only the second executive editor of that journal. And it's been a pleasure. You know, a lot of academics tend to shy away from journal editing, because it's so much work and detracts from your own research. And I must say, it's had that kind of influence, but I've cherished the opportunity to actually use the journal to influence the field in many ways. And I think that's a very that's a privilege, and I've enjoyed that work and continue to enjoy that work. So that's something that I've been doing. And as a result of all of that work, done a lot of consultancies for the Commonwealth of Learning and World Bank in the developing world. And as a result of that, the Open University of Sri Lanka awarded me a D.Litt honoris causa in 2014. I think, 2014 it was. I've also been the president of the Open and Distance Learning Association of Australia. And more recently, I'm very pleased to say that I was able to attain the principal fellowship of the Higher Education Academy. I was very, very thrilled by that. So that's a bit of a snapshot of where I came from, where I've been, and where I am.
It's a very rich and deep career, Som, it's got to be said. I mean, there's some fantastic achievements there. And that enough is to make you a leader and legend of online learning. But tell us something about the ideas and themes your work has provided, especially those that you think are still pertinent today.
A lot of what I went through, I think, mostly at Concordia University in their tech program by way of learning design, instructional design. But more so, the 6 to 8 months, I think it was, I spent at the Institute of Learning Sciences at Northwestern University in Chicago, I think was very influential in forming my views. Traditionally, you know, instructional design has been very much a systems analysis design development approach. But Roger's work in the Institute of Learning Sciences was very much driven by a case-based reasoning approach, which was a very different view of artificial intelligence than the way normally people understand it. A lot of people think of artificial intelligence as very sort of, you know, programmatic and very algorithmic, you know, machine learning kind of an approach. But Roger's view was that the richness lies in the stories and experiences of practitioners. And if you can capture that and somehow or the other put that into the engine, which he called the engines of education, you have a much more richer, but a very different view of artificial intelligence. So I was deeply embedded in influenced by that kind of thinking, as opposed to the very systematic approach to instructional design and development. And I think those were the ideas that are very pertinent and robust, and they will never go away no matter what kind of environment you are in, whether you're teaching face-to-face or you're teaching online or you're teaching in a very rich multimedia environment. The design of effective, efficient, and engaging learning and teaching experiences. This is so I quibble with the terms learning design a lot and instructional design a lot, because I think that they do not place the emphasis in the right place. And I tend to use the word learning experience design, because I believe that all you can do is really design the learning experiences of students. You cannot design learning, really. Learning is something that happens in the individual. The individual, you know, works with a bunch of things, you know, the artifacts that you put in front of them. They learn and they cognize, if I can use that word. So all you can do is design the learning experience. So I like the term learning experience designers. So I've actually renamed the positions of my staff here as learning experience designers rather than instructional designers or learning designers. Because it promotes this message that all you're doing is designing productive learning experiences for your student. And this idea of design is very important. And I see design, as Herbert Simon talked about, the sciences of the artificial. Design is a science in itself. It's a science of the artificial, and it has a large amount of it is creativity, and some of it is scientific. And I think that that's a thing that we miss a lot. What is design, and how do we engage with design? And I think that is a very important point that permeates a lot of my thinking. This idea of choreography is also very, very pertinent, because, you know, a teacher is one might think of a teacher in this day and age as a choreographer. Most of the time what you're trying to do, and it's a metaphor that I like, when you think about what a teacher does, a teacher choreographs the situation, you know, the environment that learners are in, puts people together, puts artifacts together, brings people together, and designs the experience. And when that is very carefully orchestrated, then learning is great. And this is what, you know, Ken Robinson used to talk about a lot, you know, and he's talking about what the role of the teacher is in that sort of position of a director of an orchestra, so to speak. So I like those metaphors are useful, because they might be alien to a lot of education people, but they do bring home the point that, you know, the role of the teacher is that of a choreographer. And when a learning experience is choreographed, not to the nth degree, because when you do that, then you constrain creativity, isn't it? So you gotta leave room for some creativity by the students as well. So Getting the mixture right between structure and guidance is very important. I know that's a big debate, because some people might say, look, you need to nail this thing down. You know, you need to be very specific to the point of telling people how many words your assignments are going to be. Now, I am not in that camp. I think you got to leave quite a bit of room, depending on the level of students you're talking about. So they let the student determine and decide, you know, what their product might be and it might look like, as opposed to telling them exactly what to do.
Yeah.
And this is the idea that Ken Robinson promoted, that the real role of the teacher is not to teach not to teach subjects or content, but to teach students, teach people, isn't it? I mean, and I've worked with the problem-based learning, and because these are models, when all said and done, so how do you put these things together? And scenario-based learning, case-based reasoning, which is what Roger talked about a lot, and learning. And another point that I quibble with quite a bit is people talk about learner-centeredness. Well, of course we are learner-centered, but that doesn't say enough. I think the point is about being learning-centered, so that when you are focusing on the learning experience, then of course the learner is there, but the individual is not important. It's the design of the experience that is important. So I think these ideas have been around for a long time, but oftentimes get lost in the milieu. And I think they are very important, and we need to be reminded about these ideas all the time, so that we need to refocus our attention to make sure that we are focusing on the design of the productive learning experiences for students. And when that is done, no matter where you are, whether you're a distance educator or you're in the classroom or you're in Oxford or Cambridge or wherever you are, these are germane principles. They are relevant anywhere, anytime when education is important.
Absolutely. Yeah, I quite like the difference that even just a change in terminology can make. So, for example, learning experience design rather than learning design, or even, heaven forbid, instructional design, and learning-centered rather than learner-centered. I mean, they're subtle differences, but very meaningful.
Yeah, that's true. Totally agree.
So, Tom, we're approaching the end of 2020, and obviously COVID has made quite a big impact on the world and how education is offered. What are your observations about online learning and education at the present time?
Well, obviously, I mean, the COVID-19 has really made a huge difference in the answer that I would have given a year ago, or anybody would have given. But one of the simplest ways of sort of capturing where we are at the moment, if I can steal a couple of phrases from Charles Dickens, you know, Tale of Two Cities, I think these are the worst of times, right? We've never seen anything like. But I dare I suggest these are the best of times as well for us in education. For people like us who have been in the business of distance education, and we've been banging on the doors of conventional educational practices for decades to say, listen, technology can empower, you know, learning doesn't change. And I've spent the last half hour talking about the basic principles of learning and teaching.
Yeah.
What changes is just the environment, and environments will change. They have changed in the last decade. They will change in the next decade. They will change when we are gone from here. So let's not be distracted by the environment. Let's focus on the key issues of learning and teaching. So I think, you know, these are the best of times, because suddenly, despite all the evidence in favor of thinking about how technology can empower learners and teachers, you know, schools like Cambridge, Yale, Stanford have just suddenly have to stop everything and put everything online. No questions asked. Whereas, you know, 10 years ago, they would be arguing, you know, tooth and nail, you know, to say, you know, face-to-face education should be protected. So I don't think we can have a better opportunity than this. I'm sorry to put it that way, but, you know, while there are downsides of where we are, but for education, this is an upside, because it really has, it's really forced our hand to think creatively about learning and teaching. And believe you me, you know, it's not going back to where we were. We are not going back to where we were. We will have to move forward, and we'll have to re-engineer, and nothing is better than forced to do it. So I think conventional educational organizations in all sorts of ways will have to rethink how we have taught before, And this is going to take some time, but I think the path is very clear. We don't need new knowledge. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. We know a lot about learning. We know a lot about teaching. Mm-hmm. And we know a lot about technology. There's bucket loads of experience in places like where you and I work that we can draw upon. The problem I see is that a lot of organizations are just ignoring all of that. And I cringe when people start talking about remote teaching. I mean, what is that? Mm-hmm. You know, when distance teaching or distance education has been around. So what I'm finding is that people are panicking and people are jumping very quickly and grabbing onto whatever they can grab on and making mistakes that they don't have to make. They just have to wake up and listen to a lot of experience that is out there in the world, in open universities and distance teaching operations, in online learning operations, how to do this better. We know about discussion forums. We know about communication online. We know about how to use videos and how to develop, design, and shoot videos. This is not new. There's a lot of literature around. There's a lot of experience around that. So I'm interested in the knowledge base and the capital that lies, the intellectual capital that lies at the intersections of technology, education, which is learning and teaching, and design, because these three areas now have to come together. So when I put it that way, obviously you'll find that traditional education systems with traditional or conventional educational practices and conventional training of educational practices is not going to be enough, because as you and I know, most academics, you know, come to teaching with a very strong research and academic background, but very little experience with technology and very little understanding of design of educational experiences, let alone design of anything, you know. So I think that there are three bodies of knowledge, which is what I think, you know, the idea of TPEC is about: the technological knowledge, the pedagogical knowledge, and the content knowledge. So content knowledge alone is not going to be. But this is not new, Mark. We've had this before. So I think that our hands are being forced now, and we need to think about this. We need to think about how our teacher education programs need to be redesigned to make sure that the teachers that we train from here onward, both, you know, for those who teach in the primary and secondary schools and for those who teach in the tertiary education sector, how we can develop their professional competencies and capabilities and proficiencies in the area of educational technology, the design sciences, and of course the subject matter knowledge which they have. So I think that is something that organizations will have to think about, you know, very carefully and for years to come, for decades to come, I think.
Absolutely. So, Sam, have you seen that done well, that the response to COVID? Are there examples that you think are worth highlighting?
Oh, I think many of us are doing very well. I mean, may I brag about USP? The University of the South Pacific has done extremely well, you know, unlike most universities in Australia, and you know that I'm familiar with Australian universities, and USP is miles ahead, you know, partly because over the last decade or so, USP has already been moving on flexible learning. I am the Pro Vice Chancellor of Flexible Learning, you know, here. So we have had that mindset about, you know, flexibility is the name of the game. No matter where you are, COVID or no COVID, the lifestyle that we lead these days and the environment that we are living in these days, whether you're a city-based university or a regional university, everybody wants flexibility, but flexibility that is carefully managed and orchestrated. So when COVID hit, USP was already 80% of its programs were in blended mode. So we had only 20% of courses that were fully face-to-face. I mean, largely because you needed hands-on work in laboratories and places like that. I mean, I'm not suggesting also that face-to-face learning and education is going to disappear. No, not at all. Because there'll be some things that are more efficient and effectively done in a face-to-face environment, and so be it, and that's the way it's going to be. But a lot of what we do can be done without having to be in a physical place at a particular time. Mm. So, you know, flexibility is not new. It's almost imperative. So the University of the South Pacific is a very good example of it. Of course, a lot of people don't know about what we do here, but I know that there are other organizations which have done very well with similar sorts of backgrounds, both in the UK, in places like India, in places like Africa, you know, mm-hmm. and places like Canada, organizations that both you and I will know about.
Great. Som, imagine for a moment that you had a reasonably healthy research budget. Where would you invest it? What research would you most like to see done at the moment?
Exactly what I'm sort of suggesting, Mark. I think design of productive learning experiences and learning environments. Yeah, I use those words very carefully. Like, learning experiences are not the same as learning environments. Learning experiences, I'm talking about learning experiences mostly with a view to the design of learning strategies, you know, the design of what the learner will do within a larger environment. The larger environment includes the infrastructure, the resources, the technology, the support staff, which could be anywhere. So I think that focusing attention on designing productive learning experiences in a rich, varied learning environment is my dream. You know, that's what I would love to do. And if I have a large sum of money, I would model some of those and say, well, it's good enough to talk about these principles, but how do you put all of these together in a systematic and systemic way so that whole courses and whole programs can be offered that way and not just little bits and pieces here and there? So, you know, what happens at the confluence, you know, at a more detailed level, what happens at the confluence of technology, teaching strategies, learning strategies, and the design of those strategies? For example, how do you empower people to think for themselves? How do you use technology to empower teachers to provide useful, meaningful, timely feedback? Simple things, you know. That, I mean, you know, nothing is new here. As I keep saying, you know, we know about what works, but in the environment of the future, simple things like feedback. Okay, we've been providing feedback for a very long time, all right? We know how to do that. But how do you provide feedback in a flexible learning environment where students are not in the classroom? How do you provide feedback when feedback arrives on time and is enough and effective and efficient, not 2 months after or 2 weeks after I've submitted my assignment and I've moved on? I need feedback now, you know? So without overloading the tutor, whoever he or she may be, and wherever he or she may be, can we provide timely feedback in the organizations that you are in? And I'm sure you've battled with this all the time. So I would focus research on that. We have technologies now that will enable you to do that. For example, one of the things that we've done around here is giving feedback using, you know, videos. People haven't used video, and little videos, you can record a little feedback on your phone, upload it on a Moodle site so people can have it without really exponentially increasing the workload of the tutors and the markers and so on, if you have large numbers of students, you know. So that's the kind of research I would like to see, how you can advance the affordances or apply the affordances of technology for the promotion of the learning experience and the enhancement of the learning experience of the students, isn't it? And, of course, teachers as well.
I quite like the way you tie the terms technology, education, and design together. It's almost like a trinity of effectiveness for online education, online learning. Well, Som, it's been a fantastic opportunity to get to know you better. And I think you have provided us with a bit of a TED talk in terms of learning design and serving students well at a distance. Thank you very much for being a leader and legend of online learning.
Thanks, Mark. Thank you very much for the invitation.
You can learn more about Som and his work from our website. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.